From a transmitter atop Great Blue Hill, this is WGBH, live, local talk, Boston Public Radio.
He is Jim Browdy. I am Marjorie Egan. This is a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio on the day after the tragedy at the Boston Marathon.
You know, Boston was the center of the universe yesterday. It still is, but for all the wrong reasons. We're going to talk to a whole spectrum of people during the next 3 hours. Reporters, runners, spectators who saw it all, including one man we both know him, who lost a son in Iraq. He was at the race cheering on people who were running in honor of fallen veterans, including his son. And he hadn't ended up helping the severely wounded to survive. Homeland Security people, forensic experts, and most importantly, you at 877-301-8970 or at BPR at WGBH.org.
It was an unbelievable day. Jim was reporting on it at NECN. I was down there at the scene of not actually where the blast went off, but as close as I could get because, of course, they shut down the T and many of us were walking down there. But as I told you, Jim, I interviewed a nurse who had just finished the race a couple of minutes before the explosions. She was standing next to a family with a three-year-old child. You've probably heard about the three-year-old child who's been admitted to Children's Hospital. And she spoke about how the glass shattered, came flying out into this child's leg. As a nurse, she knew it was a compound fracture. The bone was coming out of the child's leg. I spoke to a volunteer who was in tears. It was his first time volunteering. He talked about seeing actual pieces of bodies on Boylston Street. There was this young couple that came up from Connecticut. They got to the finish line about 8 o'clock in the morning because they're marathoners themselves, hoping to get a number to compete in Boston. You have to qualify, of course, for the Boston Marathon. And they came up and got there about 8 o'clock in the morning and talked about what a beautiful, wonderful day they'd had. And then Armageddon, and the woman spoke of seeing a young runner with shrapnel in both her calves, screaming and saying, "What happened? What happened? What happened?" They spoke of seeing a young man whose shoe had been blown off, screaming, panicking. It was just a horrible scene. It was like a war zone. It was like you were in another country, not the United States of America.
And we've all read the story of the 8-year-old little boy from Dorchester who was there with his sister and his mother watching his father finish the race. He was killed, his mother and sister injured. We've read about the mother whose two grown sons each lost a leg. This morning, the most recent official update, there was an endless parade of local and federal officials, 9 specifically. Not much new, except the casualty figure was raised to 176, and we were told right off the top by Governor Patrick, there were no additional explosive devices, despite the reports, other than the two that went off. Well, it's 21 hours after the fact. Here to describe what the scene is like after those blasts from the scene is the host of Greater Boston on WGBH and our colleague Emily Rooney. Good afternoon, Emily.
Hey, Jim and Marjorie. How are you?
Great.
We're terrific. So what's it like down there? You live just a couple of blocks away from the finish line of the marathon. What's it like down there today, Emily?
It's really, really sad. I mean, people are walking around in tears. We were just over close to Copley Square as you could get, and people were picking up their bags. You know, they have these yellow bags that they had dropped their belongings off before the race started, and they usually pick them up at the end of the day. But, of course, they're over there picking them up now, and they're also getting their medals. And when they turn around, coming away from having picked up the medal, every one of them just kind of spontaneously bursts into tears. It's just the saddest thing. But I got to tell you guys, I spoke to any number of runners from, you know, Texas and Ottawa and all over the world, and every one of them said that they would come back next year.
Well, we were talking about that before. You almost think that this could be this massive explosion of people wanting to be in the Boston Marathon. Of course, you have to qualify, so I don't know how many people they can actually absorb to take, but that people will come back next year just to say, you know, this isn't over. This isn't going to ruin this race for us. It could be huge next year.
It could be. I don't know if they'll get as many spectators. You know, interestingly, there weren't as many spectators this year. I was remarking on that yesterday, that oftentimes at the finish line, they are 8 and 10 deep. You're really pushing to see the elite runners come over the finish line. That was definitely not the case yesterday.
Hey, we're talking to Emily Rooney. Our number is 877-301-8970 if you want to join us. Emily, what's the scene like downtown? Are stores still closed? Is part of downtown still cordoned off? What's it like?
This morning, Jim, when I walked out at about 7 o'clock just to see what my normal route would have been like, and I usually do the dry cleaners, coffee, et cetera, everything was shut. In fact, there was yellow police tape everywhere, including around lampposts, around telephone poles, so that you couldn't walk on the sidewalks. The people were very zombie-esque. They were walking in the middle of the street, on Dartmouth, on Newbury, on St. James, wherever, because the sidewalks were cordoned off. They have since taken some of that down, and as you heard Police Commissioner Ed Davis say earlier today, they're going to start shrinking the cordoned off zone. But this morning, when I walked up Newbury Street, it was like something like a nuclear bomb because everything was frozen. There was like plates set out, glasses of wine. There was a big, tall stack of onion rings still on the skewer. And everybody had just bolted from their seats. That was at Stephanie's on Newbury. So when that explosion went off, people took off wherever they were.
You know, everybody knows you're there as a reporter, but you're also there as a resident. You live just a few blocks away. What's that part of it like for you? This is your terrain. It's your turf where you hang out all the time. What's that like, Emily?
Infuriating. I don't know how else to describe it. You know, I was joking that yesterday I was actually sort of trying to avoid the marathon, and I was out in Newton, and then I came back in at around 2:30. I stepped down on the street at literally 2:50. I heard the explosions go off, so I headed right over there. And people, even 10 seconds later, they're already streaming my way. I was on Clarendon at that point, heading over towards Copley Square. But, I mean, the first thing that somebody said to me was, two bombs went off. And, you know, you get angry. I mean, that was my first response. It really, really pissed me off.
Well, that is the thing. I mean, this is such it's a holiday. It's school vacation week. It's a tradition in many families. I mean, I live a couple hundred feet from Beacon Street. For years, you go out there on the marathon route. You watch the runners go by. You bring your chairs and you bring your coolers and you bring your strollers and you bring the dog. And people have to get there early to be at the finish line. But many people make this a ritual too. School kids, college kids. And you can't help thinking, I mean, particularly me, because I'm sort of a big chicken. And, you know, so next year we go, but next year we go looking over our shoulder wondering about every stray bag we see. It's going to change this whole ritual forever.
I don't know, Marjorie. I mean, I always say I can't believe the security at this thing to begin with. It felt, as of 24 hours ago, it felt like overkill. You've got Homeland Security.
Yep.
You've got the FBI. In fact, the FBI, I happen to know this because a friend of mine was over at Abe and Louie's, and the FBI was there. You know, the elite runners had finished the race. They were in the restaurant. They weren't drinking, but they were there. And it was like things were winding down, and it was when the masses were coming across. So my point is that it can't get any tighter than it was. And you heard Ed Davis say this morning, they swept an hour before the race gun went off.
Right.
So, you know, if somebody's going to do something like this, they're going to do it. You know, you can't protect against everything.
Emily Rooney, last question for me is, I know that there are not as many people in the street as you might ordinarily see, normal people. I spoke to two of my former colleagues from NECN who are now in different parts of the country, both of whom are flying in today to cover this at least through the end of the week. Is there a clear presence of reporters around the country in and around the, the finish line, the crime scene?
Oh, you know where they're set up? They're set up in on the Boston Common, on Arlington and Boylston. So right on the corner there, all the networks are there, the lights, they've got their sets set up. So the backdrop to that would be Arlington Street. And then Arlington Street, as you look up Boylston, you know, if they're standing on that corner on Arlington, looking up, it's just eerie. It's just littered with stuff, and it's just a dead zone. No one's on it. Things are blowing around. So a lot of people are standing there taking pictures. The reporters are kind of across the street from that. There's a huge national, international presence. I mean, a lot of them were here anyway.
Mm-hmm. Right.
And now tons of them are here now.
So Emily Rooney is going to be covering this extensively tonight at 7 o'clock on Greater Boston, we all presume. Emily, thanks for taking the time to be with us.
Of course.
Emily, we'll see you in a bit. You're listening to Boston Public Radio, 877-301-8970. If you want to join us, Barack Obama spoke last night. He held a briefing at 11:30 this morning in the White House briefing room. Here's part of what the president had to say.
This was a heinous and cowardly act. And given what we now know about what took place, the FBI is investigating it as an act of terrorism. Anytime bombs are used to target innocent civilians, it is an act of terror. What we don't yet know, however, is who carried out this attack or why, whether it was planned and executed by a terrorist organization, foreign or domestic, or was the act of a malevolent individual.
Now, you might say the president was stating the obvious, that it was terrorism, but yesterday when he held his briefing, he didn't use that word. Now, again, he is stating what I think all of us know. One of my colleagues, Marjorie, from NECN, was on the marathon route right across the street from the blast, covering a very different kind of story than she ended up covering. She joins us on the phone now. Jackie Bruno, welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for having me, Jim. Thank you, Marjorie.
Hi, Jackie. So I understand, Jackie, that you were there not only at the finish line, not only to cover the race, but also to cover a wedding. Tell us about what you were doing.
You know, it's just such a funny thing because I started the day so excited about my story. I got this NECN exclusive, and it was a lighthearted feature about a couple from Dallas that were going to be running the race. And then they were going to be getting married at 5:30 that evening on the in the public gardens near the Boston Common. And they were so thrilled. I had interviewed them earlier in the week and got those pre-interviews. We did a preview about them. And then they weren't going to talk to anyone else. This is my story, you know, and I was so proud of it. I was so excited about it. I was so happy for them. We got them as they were finishing. They finished pretty early because they're pretty elite runners, and they were so thrilled. And we left them, and they were going to go get ready, take a shower, and change into their wedding clothes, and we were going to be moving our car to the Common. So when this happened, we were walking up, but we were in a huge crowd right by where probably the first explosion went off, but a little bit earlier than that. We're in this large crowd. We actually ducked into Lord & Taylor because we're just trying to get out of the crowd and went through the parking garage that we were in through there. And I honestly think that that was godsend, because if we got stuck in that crowd, we might have been in the way of shrapnel. If it was powerful enough to come across the street, we really couldn't move there. And then you always wonder about trampling. So I'm really happy that we were able to get into that garage, get into our car. We paid. I have it still, the stub from the parking garage. It says 249. And seconds later, I heard the first explosion. And then quickly after, the second explosion. The second one was much stronger because it was right outside of our parking garage for the most part. We were on Exeter Street, right between Lord & Taylor and the Lenox Hotel, and the Wilson Street was right there. And as it went off, we were coming up to the street. So we were about to take the right to go towards the other side, not away from Boylston. Instead, we just stopped the car. My photographer, John Hammond, just grabbed his camera and started running towards the bombing. Meanwhile, this swarm of people were coming at us. It seemed like something out of a movie, like when Godzilla comes and everybody runs away. That's what it looked like was coming at me, and I thought, I'm going to get trampled. But I knew I had to run out there and see what was going on. So I ran through the crowd, and what I saw is haunting me today, especially. What I saw was, and it's hard to sanitize it. I think somebody at one point said, maybe you should say extremities. I saw people's legs blown off. I saw somebody without a foot. Now that I see the picture of the 8-year-old boy that died, I saw an 8-year-old boy, I didn't know his age at the time, but I saw a boy around that age getting carried away by a cop, and he had blood all over the side of his face. And I thought, this cop isn't running. Why aren't you running? Run, get him to an ambulance. And he was walking, and the boy didn't look pretty lifeless. It didn't register with me that that boy may have been gone, but now I'm feeling like I might have saw that boy. That was the boy. It makes sense now why he would not have been running. I saw smoke. I saw people who were trying to help these people. And I remember specifically the guy who had no legs. At first I thought, does he have on red running shoes with his shoelaces hanging? That's what it looked like at first. And I realized, no, his legs are too short. And so how you process this in that situation is horrific. So then what happened was I realized I had to get the car out because I wasn't sure if there was going to be another bombing. So we realized we couldn't block the exit to the garage, so we moved our car, and at that point we weren't able to get back close enough to the scene. Then we made the decision just to get back to the station because everything was blocked off. We wouldn't have been able to get back to our live truck. We just raced the video back to the station, knowing that we had to get back there to get that there. I did an interview right away, and then I said, put me back in. So we immediately turned around and went back to the scene.
That's hey, Jackie Bruner. By the way, you and your photog, John Hammond, did great work. Two very quick questions. What was it like going back to the scene? You know, I spoke to you last night and you had been back in Newton. Obviously, it was a shocking experience as a reporter and as a human, and not that they're mutually exclusive all the time. What was it like going back to the scene of this atrocity?
It's funny you say that. They are mutually exclusive in a way because as a reporter, you're shutting off a lot of your emotions. You have to. It's like being a doctor. You can't take home every story with you. So oftentimes when you're covering these things, they're terrible, but you kind of shut off a lot of your emotions enough so you can tell the story, but still feel it. There's somewhere in between. But I had to, at first I was running on adrenaline, I think, and I said, put me back in. I got to get back out there. I got to get back out there. I basically begged them to put me back in the car to get back out there, and we went right back out. And as soon as we started driving towards there, we were getting closer to the city, I turned to John and said, we're crazy. Why are we going back there? And he's like, I don't know. I don't know why we're going back there. I said, we got to go back there. We got to stay strong. And we were both afraid. And here I am, John's a grown man. You know, I'm 28 years old. I'm not a child. We were really afraid going back towards there. And logic told us that nothing else was going to happen. But then you heard that there might have been something connected to JFK. That wasn't the case. But the uncertainty was scary. But we knew we had a job to do. And my first thought is I didn't get any sound because everything happened so quickly. And we needed to move the car in case another bomb went off. I was concerned that something could happen in the parking garage. So that's why I wanted to move the car so fast. I didn't want to block anyone inside there. So I was able to get a picture. John was able to get video, but we had to exit the scene pretty quickly.
Jackie, last question for me is you said that the couple that were to be married at 5:30 on Boston Common were safe because they were elite runners and obviously crossed before 2:50. Do you have any idea if they went ahead and got married at 5:30?
Yeah, I did text them that later that night, and they said they did get married. I didn't prod too much about where they got married. I'm assuming Boston Common probably didn't happen because people were actually using that as a meeting place for family members.
But they did get married.
They were staying at the Taj, and I have a feeling that they probably got married there, and I'm sure the Taj made up for it and tried to make them as happy as possible. But they had their wedding. They said that was a beautiful moment, but they still found joy in the day. And what I'm going to do is I'm going to take some of the early stuff that I got for them on my own time, put a little something together so that I can send it down to them in Dallas so they can have that memory of the good parts of their day.
Jackie Bruner, thanks for the update, and take it easy for a day. Jackie Bruner from NECN, she and her photog, as I say, John Hammond, did wonderful work yesterday. Jackie, thanks so much for joining
us.
We appreciate it.
Thank you,
Jackie. Our number is 877-301-8970. Let's take a call or two. Nancy Schoen, actually, from West Newton, has a particular connection to this scene. Nancy, welcome to Boston Public Radio. Thanks for calling in.
Oh, thank you very much for having me on. I guess I did the tortoise and hare. I'm the sculptor who did the tortoise and hare. I also
in
did
Copley.
It was in 1995. It was installed right in Copley Square. And at that time, the end of the marathon was there. And, of course, they're still using that area for the tents and so forth. I'm sorry. I'm a little upset, too.
You have nothing to be sorry about, Nancy.
I know. Anyway, I feel very happy that somehow that's going to remain. It didn't get hurt. And I'd just like to read you what it says on
Please
the
do.
Plaque.
Please do.
It says, the tortoise and hare Copley Square was created by Nancy Schoen as a permanent tribute to the runners from all over the world who have participated in the Boston Marathon. And it was put in by the Friends of Copley Square, May of 1995. But I just had to tell you how I felt.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. And that is a fantastic sculpture. If those who haven't seen it, it is in Copley Square, the tortoise and the hare. Nancy, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much for having me on.
877-301-8970 is our phone number. We're here, a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio. Marjorie and I will be here with you and a whole spectrum of people who have a lot to say about what happened yesterday and what's going to happen in the aftermath. Again, we're here till 3 o'clock. You can also email your thoughts to BPR, Boston Public Radio, BPR at WGBH.com. Marjorie.org. Joining us on the phone was one of Marjorie's colleagues who co-wrote a story about an interview with the roommate of the Saudi student whose apartment was searched in the middle of the night in Revere. Joining us right now is Laurel Sweet. Laurel, thanks so much for being on Boston Public Radio.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be with you guys again. And I have to tell you, I was listening to Jackie tell that story about the wedding, and I just got completely overcome with emotion. So.
Yeah. It's just the whole day. I mean, it's emotional for everybody, Laurel. You had a story today. We should point out to people that this morning at the press conference, Ed Davis and other officials said there is no one in custody for this attack in the Boston Marathon. But you co-wrote a story with Orion Johnson today about a huge FBI, ATF, canines and everything else showing up at this man's apartment in Revere. What was the story, Laurel?
Well, this all began pretty early last night and continued right up until early this morning, actually. And I'm still outside the Ocean's Tower on Ocean Avenue, which anyone who's ever been to Revere Beach would be familiar with these structures. It's a huge, huge apartment building. And late last night, police, ATF, FBI, local police, Revere Fire was called in to stand by. All converged on this apartment on the fifth floor. And three men, what I'm told by one of the residents who lives in the apartment, there are three men who live in the apartment, they're roommates, they're students. And one of them came home last night, and this was his version of the event, to find police already here. And they informed him that one of his roommates, the other one he said is traveling, had been injured by shrapnel in the Boston Marathon, and they wanted to talk to him about him. They also wanted to come into the apartment, and he said he signed papers giving them permission to go in there. So I'm unclear whether there was an official search warrant that was executed or if he just certainly granted them the right to go into the apartment. Several witnesses said they saw stuff coming out. He would not describe what they removed. He also would not describe the condition they left the apartment in. But he said that his roommate is in a hospital. He wasn't sure which one. He confirmed that he was, in fact, at the marathon yesterday. And again, it was police who told him that he'd been injured by shrapnel, and they, you know, for whatever interest they've got in this individual, who he said is from Saudi Arabia, as is himself, you know, they wanted to know more about him. And he said that he talked to police for 5 hours through an Arabic translator. I asked him, could you tell us what were the questions they asked you? And he said he couldn't do that because the questions were asked to him in Arabic, and his English was somewhat limited. The two of them are both here, living here. They've been living here about 5 months, and he said they're both students in Boston where they're learning to speak English, actually.
So what do we make of this, Laurel? I mean, there obviously was a reason why this entire huge group of law enforcement people showed up at this apartment.
Yeah, and sometimes in the aftermath of these things, it's not uncommon to see something like this.
Uh-huh.
I know the head of the FBI today would not comment on why they were here and what they were looking for. They were certainly here very quickly. According to the residents of the building, there are a lot of young Saudi Arabian males who live here. A lot of them are students. And I don't know. There was some interest here, and obviously they found something they liked. Outside the apartment, and I don't know that this is related, although it struck me as kind of odd, but right outside the apartment was a folding metal closet door that looked like it had been removed from its hinges. So, you know, who knows whether they found something in a closet. He just wouldn't say.
Laurel Sweet, Boston Herald, great reporting as always, and thanks so much for giving us a buzz.
Thank you, and both of you, please take care, and best of luck to you.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Our number is 877-301-8970. Our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. That's BPR as in Boston Public Radio at wgbh.org. Let's take some calls. Mary from Fall River, you're on the line. Thank you very much for calling.
Hi. I called because yesterday I was on Heartbreak Hill, and so many of the people who ran by me were fundraisers They wore the special uniform and they wrote things on their arms. And they were there to benefit people like the Multiple Sclerosis Foundation or Dana-Farber Cancer Institute. And many of them had signs on their backs that said things like, "Connect Mom." So it was plain that they weren't there to help Mom. They were there to help future patients and their families and the medical team who would support them. And that is what keeps coming back to me, was that somebody tried to derail an effort that was at least 40% devoted to helping people who would need special care of some kind in the future. And some of those, of course, who were there in the present. But if you're raising the money, often right. It's too late to do a whole lot for the person that the hospital would get the funds for.
Hey, Mary, being at Heartbreak Hill, how did you first learn about what happened, obviously, at the end of the line? What was your first knowledge, and what was the vehicle for your learning about it?
My mother called me out in Wayland, where I was visiting my brother and his family. And the weird thing is that my sister and I got in our cars. We walked away from Commonwealth Avenue at 50. So we just missed the news.
Mm.
We were standing with someone who was greeted, we were joking about this, every 6 minutes by a runner. She knew an awful lot of people in the race, so she and her husband would have heard very soon when this happened. But I still can't believe the whole thing.
Mary, thank you so much for the call.
You know, it was a fascinating bit of information, but they stopped the runners at Commonwealth when they got near Kenmore Square.
5,000 of them.
Yes, and that's when I was down there, because they stopped the T at St. Mary's, so you had to walk, I don't know, a quarter of a mile or something from St. Mary's down to Kenmore Square. And a lot of the runners at that point had no idea why they were stopped, because they don't have their cell phones with them. You know, and it was a panic moment for them, because, of course, then they did hear that something terrible had happened at the finish line. And where are their husbands and girlfriends and families? They're at the finish line waiting for them. So there was this panicked handing around of cell phones. And then, of course, what happened is the cell phone service went out. So you were trying to make these calls, let people borrow your phones, and your phone wasn't working. And it took a while for me to figure out. It wasn't that my phone wasn't working. It was that the cell phone service had been turned off. And these people had run 25 or almost 26 miles. They're in little running outfits. They don't have the blankets around them, the aluminum foil blankets, because they're just stopped in the race, and they're milling around, shivering and freezing, and having no idea what's going on or where their family was. It was a terrible thing for those people, even though they never even got close to the finish line.
Well, also you saw interviews with family members who, hours and hours after the race had ended last night, who had not been able to get in touch with anybody. In furtherance of what you're saying, an abject panic that the person they loved or the person they were there for was amongst the injured, or possibly even amongst the dead. Our number is 877-301-8970, or you can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. We're here for a special three-hour edition. We're here till 3 o'clock on Boston Public Radio. Coming up in a minute, we'll take more of your calls at 877-301-8970, and we'll talk to Juliet Kayyem, who's a former Homeland Security official, both for Barack Obama and for Deval Patrick. Listening to a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio. We're here till 3 o'clock with you at 877-301-8970. Joining us is the former Assistant Secretary of Homeland Security for Barack Obama, Massachusetts' first Undersecretary for Homeland Security for Deval Patrick. She teaches at the JFK School. She writes a column for the Boston Globe, and she ran the Boston Marathon, just 5 years ago. Juliet Kayyem, thanks so much, and welcome to Boston Public Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Hi, Juliet. Thank you for being here. So obviously it's very early on,
right.
But what can you tell us? What do you make of this, the investigation so far? What do we think may have happened?
Well, there's a couple of things. I mean, I think it's pretty clear that the officials who just gave the press conference are looking at both the foreign intelligence stream, which is going to lead to other countries and potential chatter that we may have had beforehand, as well as the domestic threat. Now, the investigation, both investigations will be run out of the FBI, but they involve different tactics. Of course, if we're dealing with foreign countries, a lot of them don't want us to know, don't want the public to know that they're helping us. On the domestic side, there's going to be, you know, laws and other rules that govern what sort of investigation can happen here, but those will all come out through the FBI. They are pretty insistent that they are not choosing, at least publicly, which one is weighing one way or the other in terms of where they think this is heading. I think that's pretty telling. They don't want to lead in one direction and let people off the hook. My gut tells me at least 24 hours later, and I will probably be proven wrong, but just having been in this field, that the relative insophistication of the bombs, coupled with the fact no one's taking credit, coupled with this tends to be a week in which domestic terrorism comes out of the woodwork. And plus, you know, to be honest, though the Boston Marathon is a global, has a global audience or global participants, it really is a local event. I mean, it still feels like ours here in Boston. And so there's just a pieces of evidence that make me think that we're looking at more of a homegrown thing.
Juliet, you said this is a week for domestic terrorism. Why?
Well, you have Patriots Day, Tax Day, and then previous terrorist attacks that occurred this week or attempted attacks. It's just a sort of wild week in terms of anniversaries. And so that's sort of why it might be telling. Tax Day is also always a political day, so to speak.
Okay.
But I have to, you know, I'm having come from government, when the public officials say they're sort of looking at both streams, it does make me think that at least right now the forensic evidence that they are in possession of is not clearly leading one way or the other. Now the president is speaking or has spoken, and it will probably speak for the next couple of days. Maybe we'll get more from them, but at least the investigators were pretty neutral about that one fact.
By the way, and just to add to something Julia just said, obviously the most notable of the domestic acts was on April 19th,
right,
when Tim McVeigh bombed the Oklahoma City, yes, federal building there. You know, you said they weren't leaning one way or another, but I want to pick up on what you said. Tom Ridge yesterday, former Homeland Security chief, used the word rudimentary to describe, mm-hmm, the devices. They were called a crude device, or crude devices, at the press conference this morning. When has there ever been a time when organized foreign terrorists have used crude, right, devices and rudimentary devices, as they're described? When's that ever happened?
Well, at the Times Square, there was it wasn't rudimentary, but it wasn't sophisticated, that attempted attack. But I will say to you, that was sophisticated in the sense of the use of fertilizer, and the detonation was sophisticated. So that's why there's been all this focus on how did these things blow up? Was it a sophisticated cellular trigger, or was it something, mm-hmm, was it someone with a backpack? Having done the Boston Marathon security, and you both have seen it, you know, the finish line is porous. For a variety of reasons. It has nothing to do with security. It is the nature of the event. It is what we love about the event. There are volunteers. There are public officials. There are the family members hugging the marathoners coming over the finish line. It is an event that was sort of built to be as porous as we saw it was yesterday. So people who think, well, why wasn't it safer? Why couldn't we, you know, why did this happen? Or was there an intelligence failure? You know, I often say that
we're sort of built in this country, and events like that are sort of built unsafe, and that's kind of what we like about them. That's what we love about the marathon. It's not 26.2 miles. It is 52.4, because everyone lines every street.
We're talking to Juliette Kayyem, a columnist for The Globe. She teaches at the JFK School, former Homeland Security official on the state and federal level. You mentioned a minute ago that they're looking to see whether there was any chatter, particularly on the foreign side, prior to this. Ed Davis said unequivocally yesterday that they had no notice of any threats, Ed Davis, Boston Police Commissioner, in advance of this. In light of that, from what we hear about the dogs sniffing all the packages in advance, it seems the authorities did everything they should have done prior to the race. Is that a fair statement?
Yeah, I think so. I think that's at least what we know right now, so maybe something will be disclosed. But I think what we have to remember is the good news is the terrorist threat has changed. We know that the old al-Qaeda that we unfortunately faced on 9/11 has essentially evaporated. But in its place, there are always going to be people both abroad but also here. It's like whack-a-mole. There are just people who believe in a cause and believe that terror is a means to promote their cause. They are harder to find. They are not organizing with lots of people. They are not getting radicalized. They are, I know this sounds, rah-rah, but they really are cowards. I mean, I really want to say, how hard... You look at the marathon, it's not like it's a difficult target, right? And so someone just woke up, or maybe a couple people just woke up and not woke up, but planned to do this. I do think this was someone who probably knew the marathon. It's just different pieces of it sort of suggest that it was high density at the time, but also it does get more porous, more open as the public officials leave, as the elite runners, the elite runners were already awarded by the time this happened. That's how fast the front part of it is over. And
more than 2 hours earlier, for those who haven't done the chronology. Yeah,
I know. I was, these people who were finishing were sort of more my pace.
The joggers.
11-minute miles.
The joggers.
We're
talking with Juliette Kayyem, a former national security advisor. You mentioned, and we don't know this, but there were the dog sniffing, the bomb sniffing dogs at the finish line. So are we to deduce, or can we deduce, that whoever did this put these packages in a backpack or wherever after the dog sniffers went through beforehand? Do we have any sense about the timeline?
So the site was secure probably 4 to 5 days before. I know it was closed down well before the marathon. So any packages or anything that would have been a rarity would have been found. The dogs would have found it. And so that's why everyone who sort of is looking at this from afar is surmising that the event unfolded with a perpetrator there. And so that is why the Boston police, the FBI, are saying, look, you are an eyewitness. You may not know it, but you may have a picture of someone in your iPhone who is, doing something that seems innocuous. And then, 4 seconds later, someone else has a picture of that person bending over to put a package somewhere, right? So we just don't. That's why they're reaching out to the public, and the fact that they are makes me think they believe that the perpetrator was on site.
Hey, Juliette Kayyem, last line of questions, at least from me. What's the future hold? I mean, everybody's going out of their way to say, sadly, the Boston Marathon's never going to be the same. But when you tie that to what you just said a minute ago, 50-some miles of open space, the reality is, what could we possibly do short of having an armed camp 12 months from now that would cause somebody determined to create carnage to fail? I mean, what do you do?
Right. So that's going to be the challenge, is how can you keep the spirit of the Boston Marathon next year and in the years to come? But it is done. I mean, in other words, London comes back from the 7/7, the trains are running, the bus is running when they were attacked on July 7th. So there's just going to be an upbeat of security. It will clearly be the story next year, then the year after, maybe less so. So over time, we become more resilient, more used to it, and the memory, you hope fades. Is always a memory, but that we've gotten smarter for it. I will say one thing about sort of this resiliency, our capacity to bounce back, because the marathon won't be the same, but it will go on. We know that. I do think that the response and how successful it was getting those runners away from the crime scene, getting family unification started really quickly on Commonwealth Avenue, and protecting the crime scene really did lead to this sense of, I don't want to, I mean, I guess it is calm here in Boston, I guess, for your listeners. I mean, it is, it's stressful, and it's not a good thing what happened yesterday, but I do think that the response and how sort of quick it was and successful it was does give people a sense that we're pretty competent as a city, and that we can have something like this happen, and then the next day we regroup, and then the day after we regroup better. And so, you know, there's a lot to learn from this, both on the prevention side and then the response side. But the marathon will go on, and whether there's more surveillance, whether there's even a bigger police presence, probably tighter finish line. We'll have the marathon, and we'll have, you know, 52.4 miles of spectators next year.
Juliette Kayyem, before you leave, you just mentioned competence. You wrote the day of the marathon about having run it. How fast you run when you ran it?
So I regret that column. I am one of the people who wanted to you know, put a hole into the aura of the Boston Marathon, but that was based on my own idiocy, of which I ran too fast, too soon. As I said, I ran it at about 4:20. I was one of the joggers, as someone said. and I do run half marathons now. That's the civilized woman sport, and made fun but did discuss how horrible it was for me personally, the Boston Marathon. But of course, even I got into the spirit of the marathon with that column, not knowing what's going to happen, because I do know what it means for a runner and for this city. I mean, it is an amazing experience, and I'll say I did promise someone yesterday that I will run next year just in honor of what happened this year.
That terrific. Juliette Kayyem, thanks so much.
Thank you very much for being with us, Juliette. We appreciate it.
Juliette is the National Security and Foreign Policy columnist for The Globe. She's a lecturer in public policy at Harvard's Kennedy School of Government. Our number is 877-301-8970. Our email is bpr@wgbh.org.
Before we get back to your phone calls, we want to tell you that authorities have identified the second of three victims killed yesterday at the Boston Marathon attack. It is Crystal Campbell. She is 29 years old. She was 29 years old. She's a 2001 graduate of Medford High School. Crystal Campbell, 29 years old. The other identified victim, of course, is Martin Richard of Dorchester. He was 8 years old. He was with his mother and sister, both of whom were seriously injured. They were there to see their father, Bill, finish the Boston Marathon.
877-301-8970. John in Worcester, you're on with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Thank you very much for the call.
Hey, thanks for taking my call. Always a pleasure to listen to you guys.
Thank you for that.
I just wanted to, I sat down at a coffee with a friend this morning, and we're saying, what do we do now, you know, and how do we fix this going forward? Okay. And I just want to share my thought, if I may.
Sure.
I hope that Boston's response and Massachusetts' response can be one of a real sensitivity to mental health issues, just person to person, as well as, you know, on larger levels. And I went about my day yesterday thinking that this was a small guy, another Colorado or, you know, Newtown, which I now, at the end of the day, I realized, oh, wait a second, you might be wrong. It might be a larger thing, a terror thing. Who knows? But thinking that way yesterday made me think about these mental health issues. And then it got me thinking today when I realized, hey, maybe it was a larger thing. Who knows? We never hear those voices from the terrorists. And my guess, my little stab in the dark, if I can, is that that they've got some mental health issues to deal with, too. And I don't think it's a quick fix. I'm not saying that we could snap our fingers and be more sensitive to these issues and tomorrow it'll be better, but I think in the long run, hopefully we can improve a lot of people's lives and just make a nicer society that can avoid, you know, I mean, if we see these a few times a year, maybe we can see them a few less times a year.
John, we hear you. It's a horrible connection. It's the only reason we have to let you go. Thanks so much for your contribution.
You know, I just want to point out, though, along with what John was saying, there was just in the news a few days ago that they've decreased, not increased, the number of mental health beds for teenagers in a hospital in your town in Cambridge. And as anybody knows who's dealt with teenagers with these problems, it is very, very difficult to get a inpatient treatment facility for a teenager.
Well, whenever you and I talk to Jack Levin, one of our favorite people from Northeastern, I guess is the world's expert on serial killings and mass murders, and we talk about could you have prevented that, could you have known, and the answer is almost always no. He goes on and on about how we have all the rhetoric about mental health, but we have none of the, we talk the talk, but we don't walk the walk. Neil and Lynn, you're next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Welcome.
Hi, how are you?
Hey.
I don't think there's no doubt in my mind that this is a domestic terrorism incident based on the Patriots Day history with the Branch Davidian thing and
the quality of the bomb and all that sort of stuff.
And the Timothy McVeigh thing. Unfortunately, the Boston Marathon is the high-profile event on Patriots Day in the United States of America. Now, you know, there are run-of-the-mill basketball games and run-of-the-mill events, but this is the high-profile once-a-year event. But I don't believe there's no doubt in my mind that this is a domestic terrorism. And I just want to point out that I know you guys used to be on the other station, and mm-hmm. that the right-wing media drives this, encourages this type of violent behavior by characterizing president as a dictator or, you know, the Congress as elitist, you know, snobs who can't relate to the common people, and uses, you know, couches their criticism in the rhetoric of violence that actually, you know, is creating a insane rationale, if that makes any sense, for violence.
By the way, I would say much of the, you were being mild about some of the rhetoric that we've heard on radio stations through the years. And so, but as to whether or not there's a causal connection between acts of violence and the and what is said by radio talk shows, some of whom are idolized by people who do evil things. I mean, that, I guess, is yet to be connected. Neil,
I'm kind of curious about what Alex Jones is saying about this, because if you recall, during the Timothy McVeigh, the Oklahoma City incident, some people were saying that was a government plot to, mm-hmm. As a way, like a, you know, that thing that happened in Germany where there was a government plot to blow up a building in order to justify more government oppression. And I don't know if Alex Jones, because he seems to think everything is a government conspiracy.
Well, by the way, for those who don't recall also that the we said this earlier in the show, that when we were talking to Julia Kayyem a couple of minutes ago, Timothy McVeigh and Oklahoma City happened right about this time, on April 19th of that year. Neil, thank you so much for the call. And Alex Jones, for those who don't know him, most of you know him recently from his exploits with Piers Morgan when the two of them almost came to blows over the gun control issue several weeks ago. Number's 877-301-8970.
We're joined on the phone now by Father Bob Varek, who is the pastor of St. Ignatius Church. It's a Catholic church right on the Marathon Route in the Boston College campus at Commonwealth Avenue. Hi, Father Bob.
Hi, Marjorie.
Thanks for calling in. So sure. Something rather, in all this sadness and bleakness, something rather extraordinary happened at St. Ignatius yesterday. What happened?
Well, what happened was the church was opened to the marathon runners who had to stop the race right there at Commonwealth Avenue at Boston College. And apparently they were all milling around outside, and one of the Jesuit priests, Father Don McMillan, saw them and spoke with the Boston College police, who asked him if they could open up the church. And I wasn't there at the time, so Father Don had the church opened. And I came over at 5 to celebrate the 5:30 Mass, not knowing about the fact that the church was, you know, had become a kind of a sanctuary for the runners. And I walked in, and it was truly amazing and extremely moving to see so many of the runners wrapped in their silver, you know, blankets, and being fed and receiving Gatorade and whatever that they needed. And they were all over, in the upstairs church, the downstairs. I couldn't even do the 5:30 Mass because there were so many people who
were like
there.
Looked like hundreds were in there.
Yeah, it was all over the place. The people were all over. And at that, the sense that I got was that many weren't quite sure of what had happened, and they were trying to get in touch with people, and the state police, everybody was just great. And at one point, a state policeman went up into the pulpit and made an announcement, explained, you know, how long people would be there, and gave them some background of what happened and where they'd be going to. But I was, you know, as pastor, just incredibly moved. It's not, it wasn't my regular congregation that was there, and there was, you know, for example, there was a young woman who was running the marathon in a blue tutu and blue sneakers, and she was lying right down in front of the altar, and it was like whatever people needed, you let them do. You know, it was that if whatever would bring them kind of comfort and consolation.
Father Bob, wait a second. Are you trying to tell us that you've never done a Mass with someone in a blue tutu and sneakers lying in front of you?
The problem is Marjorie knows me well. I'm also a choreographer and I have a dance company.
Yes, so a lot of tutus so there.
There's not an issue with me. But I have to say the one image that really touched me most was some ingenious person. They were passing out apples, and what they did was they saw our collection baskets, and they filled the collection baskets with apples. Mm. So they were going up and down the aisles, passing out the apples with the collection baskets, and I was so struck by that, because ordinarily people are putting things in the collection
baskets. That's true.
Taking it out. And that image, for me, it was, you know, because I think spiritually and religiously all the time, it was like this, you know, feeding of the 5,000 that we hear in the scripture. There weren't 5,000, but the way people came together and wanted to care for people was just, it was extremely, extremely moving. And I was just very, very grateful that the BC police and Father Don had the, you know, the good sense to get the church open.
Father Bob Verrecht, let me ask you one last thing. Speaking spiritually and religiously, you must get asked these kinds of questions all the time when tragedies happen. When people say to you, okay, you're a priest, why does a merciful God let these things happen, especially to children?
The real challenge, I was speaking with someone today about that, you know, a lot of it has to do with how you understand who God is in the world, and that somehow if God is this mechanistic overseer who controls everything, then you are going to essentially put the blame on God, even though you might say that you will say that it's human agency that creates this pain. Particularly from a Christian perspective, you know, in the person of Jesus, we see God suffering with the world. And I try to say that, you know, we don't understand it, but I know the God that I am engaged with and the God I preach is one who is powerless in some sense because of our human freedom. And I think what God does in these situations is provide the support and care that may bring some consolation to people as they go through this process. Because it's, when you think of it, it's so arbitrary that people who happen to be in this place at this time, you know, it was, it makes no sense at all. So it's not that I want to let God off the hook, but I just don't believe that God is one who, looks at the world and says, yeah, I want you to suffer, or I want you to experience this pain. I think God is right at the center of pain and center of the healing of the pain. But that's my own kind of theological, spiritual perspective.
Father Bob Verrecht, thank you so much
thank
for
you,
taking
Father
the
Bob.
Time to be with us. And it was a great story about St.
Okay.
Ignatius. Makes me very happy. Thank you very much, Father Bob Verrecht from St. Ignatius Parish, which is a Catholic church right on the Marathon route.
Our
number is 877-801-8255. forgot the number.
877-301.
Close
enough.
Thank you.
301-8970. By the way, multiple outlets are now reporting that explosive devices contain nails and ball bearings. One of the devices may have been housed in a metal pressure cooker. Our number again is 877-301-8970. You're listening to a special 3-hour edition. We'll be here till 3 o'clock today of Boston Public Radio. Eve in Newton, you're up next on Boston Public Radio with Jim and Marjorie. Thank you for the call.
Thank you. Hi, my name is Eve. I'm from Newton, and I have lots of stories, but I will just focus on when I became aware of what had happened. And I had just left the whole group from Mass General Hospital Pediatric Care Unit and was walking back up Comm Ave just to chat with neighbors and say hello and be part of the whole scene. And I noticed this man running in the street yelling, and yelling, as it turned out, at his daughter to stop running. So everybody else just kept running, but she stopped running, and I was able to make out what he was saying and didn't know at that moment whether it was true or, you know, what, and grabbed my husband, and we ran into a neighbor's house and turned on the TV and watched what happened. I was then standing with friends, all who've been battling all sorts of tragedies in their life anyway, and had runners in the race, and they were all done because we didn't know how to get hold of people.
Eve, how did the daughter react to this, to her father yelling at her to stop
running? Well, she was in a daze. She was stunned. She was running. We were at mile 20, and she was just stunned. And we then, when we went back out under the street, we stopped a couple people and told them, and one girl said, "Can I use your cell phone?" And we said, "We'd be happy for you to use it, but there's no cell service."
Right.
And we said, "Can we take you somewhere?" And she said, "Well, I'm from Utah." And we all laughed and then sent her into the neighbor's house to use the landline because her parents, she had just run by her parents a half mile back, and they were on their way down to the finish line to get, you know, to meet up with her.
Eve, thank you very much for the call. And I'm glad that Eve mentioned Mass General, all the hospitals. There was a surgeon on television last night from Mass General who had talked about the various injuries. And he said, you know, we're used to dealing with accidents. We're used to dealing with gunshots and with knives. We're not used to dealing with what resembles war zone-like injuries with the shrapnel and the lower limbs and the extremities, the injuries. And he talked about how he'd done 6 surgeries in one day. And then you saw the physician from Brigham and Women's on as well. And, of course, a lot of the children had been transferred to Children's Hospital. And there was a young child, 3 years old, that was hit by shattered glass, and a 10-year-old that was also injured. So there were several children that are at Children's Hospital, but how grateful. You know, people always joke, if you're going to be sick, this is a great place to be sick in. And in a situation like this where there's a trauma, the hospitals in Boston, imagine how much life-saving is going on there right now, even as we speak.
877-301-8970 is how you get to us. We're going to take a brief break. When we get back, we're going to speak to you. We're going to speak to our colleague, Philip Martin, who has been at every one of the press conferences held by public officials in the last 20-some hours. We'll talk to a Boston Herald reporter who was running the race yesterday, who reached the finish line just as the blast went off. That's all coming up on a special 3-hour edition. We're here till 3 of Boston Public Radio. Welcome back to Hour 2 of a special 3-hour edition of Boston Public Radio, and well beyond our leaving at 3 o'clock today. GBH Radio is going to be covering this wall-to-wall. 7 o'clock, a special edition of Greater Boston with Emily Rooney, who you heard with us earlier today, who lives right by the scene of this horror show yesterday. Our number is 877-301-8970. We do want to hear from you. You can email us as well at bpr@wgbh.org. Before we get back to your calls, our colleague Philip Martin has been at all three, I think it's three now, of the availabilities that public officials have had, including this morning's at 9:30, when a parade of nine local, state, and federal officials took the mic to tell us not terribly much. Philip Martin, thanks so much for joining us.
Jim, how are you?
Marjorie? Excellent. Thanks for the call.
So where are you now, Philip, and what's going on?
I'm still at the Westin. The Westin, of course, as you know, has been set up as a command center for the FBI, ATF, and the Boston Police investigating this, what they call a crime. They have not elevated this yet to an act of terrorism, though the president has used that word, and others are using that term freely right now.
And what and is there anything new? We do know that they have identified a second victim, 29-year-old Crystal Campbell of Medford, was one of three victims that was killed yesterday. Is there anything new on the investigation or anything you can report on?
Well, you know, this press conference that you mentioned, that where you're right, not a lot was said. It was sort of a mixture of cheerleading the city in the way that Rudolph Giuliani did in New York after 9/11. And at the same time, trying to bring the public up to speed on what's happening, at least what's happening as far as they can talk about. I mean, we do know a number of things. We knew, you've probably already talked about the fact that there was a, the police went to the home of a person of interest. It might be too soon to call him a suspect. A Saudi national went out to Revere, to the Ocean Shores Tower apartment complex in Revere. They searched the fifth-floor apartment. One police officer I spoke with here, by the way, said the place was a mess. But anyway, they went to the apartment in connection to the bombing. The individuals in question did not seem stable in the sense that they seemed like they were just sort of staying there, but not living there. Suitcases were one suitcase was packed, according to one source here, and they're not sure what to make of that. But again, this person has not been elevated to a suspect. He's a person of interest.
Hey, Philip, can we get back to this press conference this morning? I mean, the two things I learned watching this, you were there, is the number of casualties was raised to 176, and the governor, who was the first person to speak, said despite earlier reports, there were no additional explosive devices beyond the two that actually went off. Did you sit there saying what we said to ourselves? Why are nine people taking to the microphone to say virtually the exact same thing, which is we need your help. We need, if you have video, if you have any information, please get it to us. I understand the governor. I understand the mayor. I understand the FBI agent in charge.
And Ed Davis.
But what was the rationale for nine people taking to the microphone other than potentially ego or turf or something? What was that all about?
Well, I think we have to acknowledge that there are always theatrics involved in this type of press conference. Albeit the sincerity of some of the officials, of, I should say all the officials involved, everyone I'm sure is sincere in the sense that they feel bad about what happened and are concerned about the what happened to the city and those people who were injured and killed. But there is a degree of politics in all of this. And so if you ask why Dan Connolly was there, well, he's running for mayor. Why he made a statement? Well, he's running for mayor. That statement, it was essentially amounted to cheerleading. Why would he do that? Well, no doubt he feels sincere about it, but also he's running for mayor. So I think that's the answer to the question. And then there are some of the other individuals who did not speak, for example, they do in fact play a role in terms of the either terms of the fire department or public other aspects of public safety. So they were there as a backdrop to emphasize the point of that the city workers are out there, police are out there, firemen are out there, investigators are out there caring for you. That thing, that's messaging, it's theatrics, and it's partly politics.
You're a kinder soul than I, Philip Martin. Hey, Philip, before we let you go, and you've done great reporting on this over the last 24 hours, or I guess it is now 22 hours and a little. We knew well in advance that the governor and his colleagues are going to be holding this event at 9:30 this morning. Have they given you any indication as to when they will be briefing the press and the public again next?
Well, they did say that they would not be doing that today unless something something significant happens. So far, I haven't heard anything. I've been making phone calls to try to determine where we are in the investigation. And there are a number of people who, of course, have been looked at. The police were talking to a person of interest at Brigham and Women's Hospital who had apparently his hands were burnt in the believed to have been burnt in the during the explosion. How they were burnt, it's not clear, but that also is a person of interest. The FBI and the police are making appeals to the public for a video, Instagram, anything that might show, basically help them along in terms of this case. But as far as another press briefing, we were told that would not happen unless there was a break in this case.
You know, you just said one thing there, Phil, before we let you go, and I think one of the nine people who took to the microphone said a variation on a theme. Yesterday at the finish line may have been the single most photographed location on the planet, maybe during the day, but surely at that particular time, finish line, and maybe that's what the terrorist or terrorists wanted, but clearly there's probably a lot of evidence out there. Philip Martin, thanks so much for your time. We really appreciate it.
Jim, Marjorie, thank you.
Thank you, Philip. We are joined now on the telephone by Chris Cassidy. He's a Boston Herald reporter who ran the marathon yesterday in honor of his late mom, and he arrived at the finish line just as the explosions happened. Chris, thank you for joining us.
Hey, Chris.
Hey, thanks for having me.
Chris, what did you see? What did you hear?
I just crossed the 26-mile marker. I had 0.2 miles to go. I was on Boylston Street. The last thing I remember was a friend of mine, actually on the other side of Boylston Street, yelling out my name, "Way to go, you're almost there." And I heard what sounded like cannon fire coming from the finish line, and I saw smoke rising up. And my first instinct was that this was, you know, not a big deal, maybe a military salute, it's Patriots Day, who knows. And then a few seconds later, I heard the second explosion behind me, and that's when I turned around and saw that there was a trash can that had been blown away, and there were some casualties, some very seriously injured people. And then, you know, I think at that point, everything stopped. The marathon stopped. Runners were jumping over the metal railings, just trying to get to safety. I think we all were sort of bracing for a third explosion, and nobody really knew where it might come from. Those were some pretty scary seconds, and that's how the Boston Marathon ended.
Well, Chris, you know, you've just run 26 miles, which is a pretty big deal, and you're kind of physically pretty depleted, I would think. Was it almost a surreal thing? I mean, were you kind of in the ozone seeing this, or did you just snap right back when the danger of the situation became apparent?
No, it honestly just felt like it was some kind of dream, and that I couldn't process the reality that this was really happening in front of me. It seemed, I mean, you're right. At that point in the race, your head is down, you're hurting everywhere. You just want to get to the finish line and have the thing over with. And then to see something like this happen, you're not even sure if you can believe your own eyes. I mean, it was just so surreal.
And how did you get from, how did you proceed? Because many runners were confused, didn't know where to go, didn't know where to meet their friends. What did you do after the end of the race and the explosion? What did you do?
The Boston police were directing people away from the finish line. I sort of got pushed back into the Copley Mall. I had nothing on me except for my cell phone, which was at about 5% battery. I had no wallet, no money or anything. So, you know, we were all just sort of pushed in there. The Copley Mall was on a lockdown for a little while. Inside, there were a lot of shoppers that, you know, I don't think really knew what was going on. And then you had a lot of runners and some of the spectators that were just kind of taking cover. So nobody really knew how to proceed. I think at that point, you could really take a moment to say, well, thank God, you know, we're alive, and we hope everyone else is too.
We're talking to Chris Cassidy, who not only is a reporter for the Boston Herald, but as you heard, reached the finish line exactly at the moment that these blasts went off. Chris, how many, I know you don't have a precise number, how many people actually were allowed to cross the finish line after you? I mean, was that essentially when the Boston Marathon officials and the police decided enough is enough, this is over?
Yeah, I never actually crossed the finish line.
You didn't?
No, no. I was 0.2 miles away, and then the second explosion was so, I think, so shocking to people, it just ended, and that was it. And, you know, when I heard the first explosion, I didn't think it was, you know, as bad as it obviously was. I kept running. I thought, you know, nothing's going to keep me from the finish line. That's the way all marathoners think. And then after the second one, it was clear, you know, it's time to get out of here. I think after the second one, if, you know, nobody crossed the finish line after that, or at least the people that were maybe a couple feet away might have, but it just disintegrated at that point. And I know from other runners on my team, some of them that were under the overpass near Mass Ave and sort of Kenmore Square area, the police immediately just stopped the race, made people just kind of stay under the overpass, and that was it. You just basically froze where you were.
We're talking with Chris Cassidy, a reporter for the Boston Herald, whose story, a great story about this terrible situation, is in the Herald today. Chris, you are one of thousands of runners who was running this race in memory of someone. In your case, your mother. You were one of the thousands of runners that was raising money for charity. Tell us about the charity that you were raising money for.
Well, I was raising money for the Leukemia and Lymphoma Society. I'm part of the Team in Training program, and I dedicated the run this year to my mother, who had passed away in May, you know, suddenly, and I just, you know, wanted to, you know, she had suffered from psoriatic arthritis for most of her life, and I don't know, you know, I just felt, you know, I am lucky enough to have, you know, a good set of legs, and I did, you know, didn't want to take for granted the fact that I could run a marathon, so I just wanted to, you know, dedicate that run for her.
What do you think about your you think you'll run a marathon in Boston again?
Absolutely, and I hope that what comes out of this is that more people will come out and run. People that were on the fence, you know, will say, you know what, we're not going to let this, you know, stop us for a lot of people, this is a lifelong goal. It's on a bucket list, or maybe it's something that they really enjoy doing. But, you know, you can't let this event, you know, stop you from doing the things that you love to do. I love running, and I love the Boston Marathon. I hope to be back next year, and I hope even more people come out and even more spectators come out, just to show that Boston is resilient and that, you know, we're going to proceed as a city.
Hey, Chris Cassidy, I totally share the sentiment. I know Marjorie does too. Thanks so much
for
running, and thanks so much for your work and your call. We appreciate it.
Sure. Thank you.
Our number is 877-301-8970, or you can email us at bpr@wgbh.org. Marjorie and I are here till 3 o'clock today for obvious reasons, an extended edition of Boston Public Radio.
If you want to call in again, our numbers are 877-301-8970, and our email address is bpr@wgbh.org. That's bpr@wgbh.org. We'll be right back in just a second. We have Anthony Amore coming up. He's a security expert. We have a gentleman from the Atlantic magazine who will be telling us about the forensics involved in looking for what may have caused this explosion, who might have been involved with this. Stay tuned, a special 3-hour edition of Boston Public Radio at 89.7 WGBH. We'll be right back.
You're listening to Boston Public Radio. Jim Browdy and Marjorie Egan, a special three-hour edition. We are here with you until 3 o'clock, and we hope you join us at 877-301-8970 or BPR, Boston Public Radio, BPR at WGBH.org. Everybody is talking about the little 8-year-old boy, Martin Richard from Dorchester, who was killed yesterday. As I assume you know, his mother sustained a head injury. His sister, who is also there, has a serious leg injury. His father, who had just finished the race, his name is Bill Richard, who was a community activist in the Ashmont section of Dorchester, has issued a statement. We'd like to share it with you. My dear son Martin has died from injuries sustained in the attack on Boston. My wife and daughter are both recovering from serious injuries. We thank our family and friends, those we know and those we have never met, for their thoughts and prayers. I ask that you continue to pray for my family as we remember Martin. We also ask for your patience and for privacy as we work to simultaneously grieve and recover. Thank you. In the days ahead, this is going to be one of these situations where we're going to hear scores of stories. There are two others who are dead so far, roughly a dozen as of this morning, who are critical condition. We don't know what's going to happen to them. Obviously, we wish them the best. And somewhere in the neighborhood, according to officials this morning, of a total of 176 casualties. And we've heard very few stories. So as time goes ahead, Marjorie, we're going to hear story after story after story about families that were ripped apart by this random act of sadistic violence yesterday at 2:50.
Well, several people have reported, including WBZ, that neighbors were outside the home this morning of the Richards with dropping off flowers and dropping off candles. The 8-year-old little boy was a student at Pope John Paul II Catholic Academy, and the school released a statement talking about young Martin was a kind, caring, and loving young boy who had a great excitement for learning. And you see pictures of this 8-year-old boy with his, you know, big teeth just coming in. It looks like he's at a baseball or some kind of sporting event. And not only is he gone, but his mother and sister are seriously injured. There's a third child who apparently is okay, but there are these other terrible injuries in this family.
877-301-8970. Joining us on the phone is a guy who's a security expert. In fact, he was involved in a Boston event of huge magnitude, the Democratic Convention in 2004. Anthony Amore, thanks so much for joining us.
My pleasure.
Anthony, you know an awful lot about security, and you handled, as Jim said, the security at the DNC. There's been a lot of questioning about the security at the marathon. What do you think?
I think that anybody who's worked in security for a number of years can tell you there's no such thing as 100% security. And if somebody wants to do something to hurt people, there's a good chance they'll be able to do it. I think the city was well prepared. I think that the response to this has been amazing, and it shows that there's a lot of resources devoted to preparing for emergencies like this. But I think security was what it could be, and I know for a fact that months of coordination and work went into preparing for this, and it's really not fair to criticize the security at this point.
So what happens going forward? I mean, we all know that in the immediate aftermath, it's still a crime scene at or near the finish line, and obviously it's still cordoned off, even though the perimeter is getting smaller from what we understand from Boston Police Commissioner Ed Davis. Fast forward a little bit to a month from now, to a year from now, when the 118th Boston Marathon happens, Anthony. How do you secure open space like that ever?
Well, you try to set up a secure perimeter and control the flow of people. It's very, very difficult in that type of scenario, as you're making the point. In 2004, when we did the DNC, we had the same sort of challenge, people coming all over towards Causeway Street and heading into the garden. And what we wound up doing at that point was setting up using screeners from the airport to check people going into the area. And it went incredibly well. I mean, that's something I can envision maybe happening next year. But it's possible, when we've shown in the 11-plus years since 9/11 that we can secure areas. I mean, one loss, one injury is too much at an event like this. But I think that the security that went into the marathon probably prevented an even worse scenario.
Yeah, but Anthony, when you equate this, at least in some fashion, to 2004, I remember like it was yesterday, Marjorie and I leaving one of the convention sessions and saying there was not one single person we saw other than a delegate or a police officer, because Tom Menino had unintentionally scared people out of Boston, basically said
highway was closed
and there were a lot of businesses really upset. You have almost the exact opposite thing with a marathon where there's a free flow of, I'm assuming, hundreds of thousands of people. And it's hard for me to believe when you say a secure perimeter that they're going to, you can imagine a situation where police and marathon officials would ask people to go by a checkpoint and potentially be searched before they're allowed to watch the last mile of a race. Is that where you think we're going?
Oh, no. I'm sorry. I probably didn't state
it. Well, maybe I misunderstood. What are you saying?
I think that you can have somewhat more control over key areas, perhaps, have more of a presence in areas like at the finish line, the receiving stand. There are measures that can be put in place in terms of personnel. But you're right. I mean, even with the Olympics or something large like that, people are going into a facility or some type of controlled stadium much easier. Something like this is very, very difficult, and that's the point I was trying to make, was that if any criticism of the security that was in place yesterday is really kind of unfair because of the challenge that's presented in something like a 23-mile marathon.
We're talking with Anthony Mori, who is an expert in security. Anthony, we were talking earlier with Juliet Kayyem, who also knows a lot about security, and she was making the point that we don't know, of course, but it's very possible that because there had been bomb-sniffing dogs sweeping the area before and the area had been secured, that when things loosened up a little bit, of course, the winners had already gotten their awards and they'd moved on, and this was much later in the race, that things were looser at that point, and that may have enabled someone shortly before the explosions went off to just kind of casually walk in there with a backpack.
Well, that is entirely possible. I mean, I have a world of respect for Juliet, by the way. And I would say that when you look at any event or anything that you need to secure, you look at the times of most risk. And the part with the highest attention where the winners are coming through would be the time of most risk. So that would be a possibility that things may have loosened up a bit. There was no actionable intelligence or any really serious threats that anybody's heard of related to the marathon, so it's understandable that maybe a little later on there was slightly less concern.
I think that makes absolute sense, and that's the time when it's most porous. So that you say to yourself, well, the marathon, the winners come in 2 hours plus, 10 minutes, whatever it is, and the people that are just out there, regular runners, they're coming in like 3 and 4 and 5 hours later. So you have a very long time to worry about security there.
Absolutely. It's a gigantic window, Marjorie, and to try to provide security for it when you have a committed person who's clearly demented and evil and who wants to hurt anybody, even if it means an 8-year-old innocent child, it's incredibly difficult to stop it. But I think the city's showing that, and your last guest was fantastic. I mean, I think next year's marathon is going to have, I will bet you that you'll have more participants than this year.
Anthony, you running next year?
I'm going to start training in about 5 minutes. I don't think I could drive it in 4 hours. But
Anthony Mori, we're counting on you, 364 days from now.
You know, this has been a sad day, but in a lighter note, I couldn't get over this yesterday when I was talking to runners, and I would speak to a woman, and I'd look at her, and she looked at me like she was about 30, and I'd say, how old are you? And she'd say, I'm 52. I said, you're 52? And running, I think, is got a fountain of youth quality to it, because there was a lot of very young looking people that were much older than they looked out on Boylston Street and Commonwealth Avenue yesterday.
There's so much truth to that, Marjorie. And, yesterday Dan Conley said, moments like these don't show our weakness, they show our strength. And in so many ways, it really did. It really does.
I think that's the case. I think it is a resilient community. Anthony Mori, thanks so much for your thoughts. We appreciate it.
Thank you both.
Our numbers are 877-301-8970. Marjorie, this morning we heard public and law enforcement officials urging the public to send information, particularly videos, and obviously a lot of videos were taken. Here to tell us what authorities will do with the videos, the voluminous amounts of videos, when they get it, from The Atlantic. He's got a great piece this morning, Alexis Madrigal. Alexis, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
So what happens? They start coming in. Obviously, people who are of good intention are going to send things, even if they think there's nothing of significance on them. They get a mountain of videos. What do the authorities do?
Right. So the first thing they have to do is actually get everything into a format that they can use. I mean, you can imagine you've got like CCTVs that are coming in, the cameras that are placed outside of restaurants, establishments. You've got people with cell phones. You've got broadcast. And so they take everything and start to put it in formats that are actually usable. And there are different types of like specialized software that people can use. There's one from a company called Ocean Systems called Detective. And it looks at this point like it's probably going to be the FBI's Forensic Audio, Video, and Image Analysis Unit, although it's not totally clear to me how much the Boston PD is going to be doing, how much the FBI is going to be doing. It's kind of hard to get information out of there right now.
Alexis, put this in context for us, if you will. I know every horrible event is different, but what kind of volume is the FBI and its their colleagues, what are they likely to get? I mean, particularly at a place where there's so many people taking videos for all the right reasons, and obviously we know what happened.
Right. Well, it's hard to know how many precisely they're going to get, but maybe we can set something like an upper bound at least. If we look at what happened in the city of Vancouver, British Columbia, they took in 1,600 hours of video over some riots a few years back. Here you have a sort of much smaller time frame, although presumably you'd want anything near the finish line. But so you have a smaller time frame, but you've got a lot more people taking video. So, you know, could be hundreds of hours, could even be into the thousands.
You know, we've all seen a photograph that many people are speculating about, a guy on top of a roof in and around the finish line, or people are speculating, does he have anything, or he or she have anything to do with the horrors of yesterday? And you see some of the news stations have magnified the photograph of the man or woman, and it's gotten fuzzier and fuzzier and fuzzier. I don't know if you've seen that, but even if you haven't, is something like that, is there potential for that to be usable, or is that just something that's a basis for fascination for all the rest of us?
It's pretty tough. I mean, there's kind of two things that any kind of evidence like this could be used for. I mean, there's the investigation itself. Maybe just knowing someone was there was useful. You can go to other cameras in the area. You can try and get other people to donate video. And then there's actually like getting it into eventually some sort of criminal proceeding. And that's like sort of a step further than we're even talking about here. I mean, there's no magic. I think one thing people should remember is there's no sort of magic thing like you see on TV where someone hits like enhance and suddenly you can see everything. If you have a sort of low-resolution photograph from a certain distance, it's just like there are actual physical limits to what you can see. And there's also, I mean, for what it's worth, there's no sort of magical software that allows people to, you know, pick out the faces that they actually want out of a particular crowd, say. So this is going to be, I think, the key thing to take away. It's going to be a very human effort with a ton of labor put into it.
Hey, Alexis Madrigal, you can find his piece on theatlantic.com. Alexis, we really appreciate your time.
Thanks for having me.
Our number is 877-301-8970.
Let's take some calls here. We have Byron from Kingston, New Hampshire on the phone. Byron, thanks for calling Greater Boston. Boston Public Radio.
Okay?
Whoops. Yep. Yeah. Yep, we can.
All right. I just wanted to say I was a participant in yesterday's marathon. I was a runner. But one of your earlier guests, the reporter from the Herald, I did not finish either. I did not cross the line, although he was much further ahead than me. I got pulled off wisely by the police along with a fellow runners about mile 21, and we were told to go to the medical tent. And I just wanted to say how impressed I was with both the professionalism and the kindness and generosity of the members of the volunteer staff who not only, you know, gave us blankets and comforted us and tried to tell us as much as they knew, even though we did not know the severity of the situation, but also giving us their cell phones and saying, here, you know, call your families, you know, make contact. And then, to me, one of the most amazing things that's ever happened to me, this woman came into the tent and said, I'm a resident of the area. I was watching the race. I live 5 minutes away from here. Any of you runners want to go out of town, you don't have any way of getting home, you want to come to my house, you know, warm up, I'll give you some tea, I'll get some warm clothes, you can call your families and make arrangements.
Wow.
And, you know, basically, I'm from New Hampshire. It took 2 hours from, you know, my wife and brother-in-law to come to get me. But this woman welcomed, and she and her family, her husband, her children, welcomed me and my fellow runners into her house and treated us like, you know, the proverbial Good Samaritan. And I'm just inspired because I'm, you know, I have this determination. I'm going to go back next year. I'm not going to run anymore. I'm 71. I think I'm done with marathoning. But I want to go back and I'm going to volunteer because I want to give back.
You know, you described the best of humanity backdropped against the worst of humanity. Byron, that was a great story, and we'll look forward to seeing you next year. Byron, thanks for the call.
Thank you very much. That was a wonderful story. We're going to take a call now from the Reverend Margot Fish in Cambridge. Reverend Fish, thanks for calling.
Oh, thank you. I first ran the Boston Marathon in 1968 with Kathy Switzer and others. And,
oh, my goodness.
Wait, was 68
the
year?
First, yes.
I was the first woman, and this yesterday was my 44th in the Boston Marathon. And I joined my husband around Hopkinton in 1968 as he came around the corner, your late husband. We were at Harvard, and it was just a beautiful challenge to express the body and run. But I would just wanted to say the spirit of the marathon has exemplified the depth of joy always and the compassion of the human race and all of its expression. And I just was a beautiful gift.
Oh, Reverend Fish, we're losing you. We're going to put you on hold for a second, Reverend, and if the line improves after we take a break, we'll talk to you yet again. That was Reverend Margot Fish. Joining us after the break, we hope, is the Reverend, also Edgar B. Herwick III. Our colleague is driving the marathon route. We're going to talk to him about what that experience is like, and we'll take your calls, 877-301-8970. We hope you'll dial us up. Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Listening to Boston Public Radio, I'm Jim Browdy. She is Marjorie Egan. For fairly obvious reasons, we're sticking around for an extra hour today. We're here till 3 o'clock. You can join us at 877-301-8970.
We had a little connection problem, but I believe we have the Reverend Margot Fish from Cambridge back, who ran the marathon. Yesterday was her 44th year, and she first ran it in 1968. Reverend Fish, are you there?
I am here, yes. And it's just... words are never adequate to express what that Boston Marathon has meant and what it means to the world. And the compassion and love and joy and support, somehow way beyond the idea of ever winning. But I just wanted to say how grateful I am to have experienced it all these years, and that paradox of sorrow for that. And one goes out with compassion, which one experiences running, and now the compassion of the hurt, but also the spirit that the joy and expression of gratitude will always be. And I bow to that experience, and thank you so much.
Reverend, let me ask you one question, though. I think you said your first marathon was in 1968. Correct me if I'm wrong, but wasn't that the year that the first female runner was pulled out of the race? Catherine,
yes,
was it Switzer?
Kathy Switzer.
Switzer.
Yes.
I wasn't pulled out. My husband was at Harvard Divinity, and in the headlines the next day, it said Jacques Temple didn't want to hassle with the clergy. And my husband had run, and I hid behind a telephone pole in Hopkinton. He'd run a year before. When he came about, I joined him. He died 12 years ago, but we both were in the areas of intellectual, well, I would say, the profession of academics and had a beautiful life and my children. But it was my 44th this year, and I run without a number because I'm not qualified to run that fast. But I just, it's just always somehow an energy, and seeing my friends afterward at a dinner party, and my granddaughter was watching, and my concern for hours was that she had been, that she was safe. But that's my story. I just wanted to say how one running this all these years is filled with the depth of gratitude for humanity and what that means to the world.
Reverend Fish, we hope you keep running for many years to come. Thank you so much. We appreciate it.
I'm a little bit past that. Eight.
No, you're not. Keep running.
Thank you Reverend very much Fish. For the call. We're joined now on the phone by Edgar B. Herwick III, who has been driving the marathon route. Edgar, hello.
Hi, Marjorie. Hi, Jim. How are you two?
Hey, what have you been doing along the route today?
So, myself and our colleague, James Edwards, you know, we sort of just thought, you know, there were people who ran this yesterday and we wanted to come and just drive along this route and see what the scene is the day after. And really, pretty much, it's tranquil out here, you guys. You know, it's a beautiful day. It's even, you know, in a lot of ways, even nicer than it was yesterday. Very peaceful. You certainly see signs, you know, that a marathon happened every so often. You're driving along and you see some signs that are still up from people who were supporting runners yesterday. You drive through the towns here, and occasionally you see the flag, the odd flag at half staff. But it's pretty quiet out here. There are people running along the route here and again, people biking along the route here and again. But that's what we're seeing here along the route. Now, we're currently on Commonwealth Avenue in Newton. So we anticipate that it's going to be a little bit different as we approach the city. Obviously, we're not going to be able to get through the full route because part of the city's closed off. So we're still interested to see what happens as we get closer the city here today.
Well, it's certainly in marked contrast to what you saw yesterday, Edgar, because you, of course, were down at the finish line of the marathon.
Absolutely. And, you know, I was down at the finish line of the marathon. One of the people who were there and heard and experienced these blasts, as we've been hearing people talk about here on Boston Public Radio today. Another person who was down there, and this is probably the most interesting thing we came across on our journey here today, was a pastor of a church in Hopkinton. And when we first got to the very start of the race today, this afternoon, maybe an hour ago, he was in a park right where the starting of the marathon is. And he was gathering sort of a makeshift prayer service. And I spoke with him for a while, and there were people gathering from his church. And he admittedly was still really grappling with what happened yesterday. He ran the race, pastor of a church in Hopkinton. He finished the race. As he said, he changed his clothes, got into some dry clothes, and was hanging around the finish line waiting for a few friends to finish as well. When the first bomb went off, he heard, and then the second bomb went off right in front of him. And he said he's standing there, and he couldn't believe what he saw. Again, reflecting what we heard from a number of people, he saw people with extremities blown off. And he said, you know, you're sort of struggling with, what do you do at this point? And you want to help, and you don't know how to help. He said he immediately started ripping down the barriers so that ambulances could make their way in. But he saw a woman who clearly had an awful injury to her legs, and, you know, he's struggling because he doesn't know what to do to help. He says there was a man from the National Guard who started, you know, screaming, let's clear this, let's clear that, clearing people out, police clearing people out. You know, and he said here he is, you know, the day after. He's a pastor, you know, he's a man of God, and, you know, he's struggling.
Yeah, but when you say struggling and with the grief, it hasn't even started. We know the name of an 8-year-old little boy and what happened to his family, and we know the name of a woman, I think from Wakefield, who lost two of her sons. A leg in yesterday. But the reality is, of the 176 people who were injured, and at least one, if not two, of the three people who were killed, we know nothing about them yet. And Edgar, as the stories start coming in and we find out they had families and they had friends and what they did for a living and all these sort of things, it, at least from my perspective, the grief has literally just begun.
I think that's right on the money, Jim. And I think that, you know, I think that this is like these kind of events, like terror events, and I know that's a weighted word. I know that's a word that people are being careful with, but there is no other word for it. You know, this was a moment that terrorized anybody who was there, and, you know, the aftershocks of it and the after effects of it, as you say, they're going to continue to resonate. Everybody's going to have a story. Everybody's going to know somebody who's gone through this. And as you said, the grieving is just beginning, and this is going to be a process. And that is what grieving is. It's a process. It's going to be a long one.
Hey, so, Edgar B. Herrick III, keep driving and keep talking. Stay in touch with us. He's out on the road, the marathon route today, our colleague. Edgar, thanks so much. You know, Marjorie, we're talking about these stories. I will never forget, on my bulletin board at our former employers, I had what the New York Times did, which I thought was one of the most spectacular things a newspaper's ever done. Do you remember they had the photograph?
Yes.
And a story about every single one of the people,
yep,
whose lives were snuffed out by at the World Trade Center on September 11th. And getting 176 people injured, and hopefully the death toll is going to stay as low as 3. But the reality is there are going to be stories of horror, and we're going to find out about these people as days, weeks, and months go ahead. Our number is 877-301-8970. If you were anywhere near the marathon, we'd love to hear from you. If you were not there, but like we, learned about it sometime after 2:50 yesterday afternoon, what was your reaction then? What's your reaction now, which is roughly almost exactly 23 hours after the fact? 877-301-8970. In our first hour today, and we're here with you till 3 o'clock today to take your calls and emails and things like that. In the first hour, we were cold by a woman who has a special connection to Copley Square. Listen to what she had to say.
I did the tortoise and hare. I'm the sculptor who did the tortoise and hare. I also
in Copley.
Yeah. It was in 1995. It was installed right in Copley Square. And at that time, the end of the marathon was there. And, of course, they're still using that area for the tents and so forth. I'm sorry. I'm a little upset, too.
You have nothing to be sorry about, Nancy.
I know. Anyway, I feel very happy that somehow that's going to remain. It didn't get hurt. And I'd just like to read you what it says on
Please
the
do.
Plaque.
Please do.
It says, the tortoise and hare at Copley Square was created by Nancy Schoen as a permanent tribute to the runners from all over the world who have participated in the Boston Marathon. And it was put in by the Friends of Copley Square, May of 1995. But I just had to tell you how I felt.
Nancy, thank you very much for calling. And that is a fantastic sculpture. If those who haven't seen it, it is in Copley Square, the tortoise and the hare. Nancy, thank you very much for your call.
Thank you very much for having me on.
I think it means a lot more today. I think probably a lot more people will do it. In the third hour, when we're here starting at 2 o'clock, we're going to be joined by a terrorism expert from Harvard, one of our colleagues who's been visiting the hospitals where the injured are being taken care of. And we're going to talk to a veteran war correspondent, actually, who's in London, who'll be talking about the London Marathon that is just, 5 days away this Sunday. But for now, it's us and you. You can join us at 877-301-8970. Let's take a call. Vera from Holbrook, you are next with Jim and Marjorie on Boston Public Radio. Welcome and thanks for the call.
Hi, Vera.
Hi, Vera.
Hi.
Hi.
I have a quick question, or maybe someone can comment on it. For example, if I had a nephew who lived in Chicago and I called the FBI or some authority and said, gee, this is my nephew, this is his name and his address, he's very deranged, he's very odd, he talks about making bombs, how far does the FBI go with that? You know what I mean? So many of these tragedies, people say, oh, yes, they were very weird. I'm not surprised. So my question being, assuming this was someone from our country, and assuming this maybe could have been stopped if the FBI knew, how much time and energy do they have to devote to this type of thing?
Well, I think it depends on the situation, what the report is. What you'll hear is they'll check into things, but if someone is not made an overt threat, if someone has not done something, that it's an actionable offense, all they can do is check things out. And at the end of that process, essentially, hopefully they keep an eye on somebody, but we also don't want them to violate this person's right to privacy if they haven't done anything.
What happened with the Aurora shooter?
Yeah.
His psychiatrist was so concerned about his mental health, the state of his mental health, that she broke the confidence of their patient-doctor relationship to report him to the police at the university out there.
Suggesting he was with imminent threats of violence.
And nothing happened. So I think when people talk about mental health concerns, this is one of the concerns that they have, that there are people that their psychiatrists or their families or someone else, the father in the Gabby Giffords shooting was so afraid of what his son might do, he took away the car. I mean, the families tend to know that these things that their loved one is in very bad shape, but it is
but it's a double problem. If someone's an adult, if someone is older than 18 years old, the reality is unless they're in a certain extreme state of mental health, there's nothing formally you can do as a parent, as a sibling. All you can do is counsel them, and then if you call the authorities, as Vera said, more often than not, nothing's going to happen.
I think we can agree. We talk a good game about mental health, and we don't put any money behind it. People know that insurance companies will not cover extensive counseling. There's not enough beds, especially for young people. In Massachusetts, and we're a pretty progressive state, we don't at all walk the walk when it comes to mental health coverage. Our numbers are 877-301-8970. And also, what do you think this means for the marathon in the future? I mean, we've had many great, brave people, including Chris Cassidy, the reporter for the Boston Herald, who said he would be back running again next year, that nothing is going to change.
Julia Kayyem, who was the former Homeland Security expert, is now at Harvard and the Boston Globe, hasn't run it in 5 years. She's promised her friends she's going to run next year.
She has, but what is going to change is that there's going to be this back of your mind thought about the person next to you, the bag that's next to you. If you're sitting near the finish line, you're going to be looking over your shoulder. The sense of innocence and sweetness and just fun of the Boston Marathon is not going to be back.
Well, but for a while, let's be clear. I mean, I'm not saying that anyone's ever going to forget this, just like no one ever forgets the atrocities from 9/11 or any lesser atrocities, if there is such an appropriate term. But you and I are perfect examples of people who complain about the level of security at the airport. All the security was implemented as in response to what happened at 9/11. There will come a point, maybe not in the 118th marathon, maybe it's the 120th, when people will start resisting the additional security. So the question is, how long does it last? How intrusive are they? And I have to say, despite the experts we've spoken to today, I am not convinced that there's much more that authorities can do in a huge open space like this without totally destroying the spirit of the marathon.
Let's go to Aaron in Brighton. Hi, Aaron. Thanks for calling Boston Public Radio, WGBH.
Hi, good afternoon. Thank you for having me on.
Thanks for calling.
I just want to briefly comment on the nature of sort of this post-traumatic sort of misinformation that's being strewn about. I was working at a food truck at Dewey Square yesterday, and I started hearing firsthand accounts from the huge amount of foot traffic that was coming my way after what occurred. It was about 2:30, 3 o'clock, and I started overhearing things before I even had a phone call from my mom asking, you know, if I was okay. And, I suppose mostly what I would like to comment on is that in these post-traumatic, in the wake of so much trauma, there's a lot of information that gets thrown about that is actually misinformation.
Like what? Yeah. What troubled you particularly, Aaron?
So I don't have a smartphone, so I started asking people what was going on, and someone was saying that maybe 12 people had killed, or that there were multiple devices around the city, and I feel like people were jumping to conclusions. I know the New York Times in particular was reporting 12 people dead at one point, and a Saudi national was in custody. In fact, no one was in custody. There was someone being held for questioning. I feel like sort of this idea of jumping to conclusions and pointing the finger is really unhealthy and stokes a paranoia in the general perception.
Well, Aaron, let me respond to what you said, and I thank you for your call. I don't have any recollection of the New York Times saying there were 12 people who were
dead.
That
was a rumor. That was thrown about.
However, and this is not direct to the New York Times because, again, I hadn't seen what the Times said. One of the major debates about the media in 2013 is those in the media whose desire is more to be first than it is to be right. And there's a lot of that. I mean, we saw a situation. I can't remember the woman's name from CNN. Do you remember the right after the Obamacare decision was handed down by the Supreme Court? Do you remember when she took to the steps? What she said is the Supreme Court had struck down Obamacare because she had only read a portion of the decision. This happened more than once. It happened with Bush v. Gore in 2000 as well, because there is such pressure, and I'm not defending this, such pressure on reporters and anchors to beat the competition rather than being accurate. So I think Aaron made a pretty good point.
There were repeated reports of FBI agents and ATF agents being at Brigham and Women's Hospital questioning a Saudi national. And there was a story today. We talked to Laurel Sweet about it. And we don't know if this is people jumping to conclusions or what, but there were FBI agents, ATF agents, canine units, immigration officials, the whole nine yards at this fifth floor apartment in Revere where some young Saudi men lived.
But what was factually inaccurate about that? And by the
way,
they were questioning.
I'm not saying it was factually inaccurate, but I think Aaron was talking about kind of stoking the anti-Middle Eastern kind of fears.
Oh, I didn't know that's where he was going. I thought when you talk about extra casualties. I mean, the reality is there's responsible journalists, and I heard a lot of this yesterday. I was part of some of it, but I also listened to a lot of coverage. Responsible journalists cited what their sources were, the reports were saying, as opposed to stating things were definitely fact. We are staying here for a third hour, a special three-hour edition of Boston Public Radio today. In the final hour, in the 3 o'clock hour, in addition to your calls at 877-301-8970 and hopefully your emails at bprwgbh.org, we'll talk to a tourism expert from Harvard. We'll talk to a Global Post reporter stationed in London about what's going to happen at the London Marathon. Whole host of things, other people who observe the carnage up close and personal. That's all coming up in the third and final hour of Boston Public Radio's Jim and Marjorie Show. That's today on 89.7.